This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Since the presidential inauguration last Friday, it's been a whirlwind of activity in Washington, D.C. Anything but boring. And joining us for a look at that first week of the Trump presidency and what could happen during his first 100 days in office are political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Ken and Howard, good to talk to both of you today.
Great to be here.
I wish there was things to talk about.
No, there's nothing. This has just been such a boring week.
Yeah, it hasn't been a. It hasn't even been a.
It hasn't
week
even.
Yet.
Well, yeah. Tomorrow's officially a week. Yeah. So, but you know, before we get into that conversation, Ken, what's the trivia question today?
Well, of course, one of the big unanswered things so far is filling the Trump cabinet, and we're going to see who gets confirmed and who doesn't. I guess the odds are that everybody does get confirmed. But well, it's going to be an Ohio-related trivia question.
Okay.
Who's the last member of Congress from Ohio who resigned to join a presidential administration?
Okay.
Oh.
Last member of Congress from Ohio who left to join a presidential administration. Okay, so I think I have that straight there, Ken.
That's correct.
Okay. If you think you know the answer to that, call us at 513-419-7100. The first correct call wins a political junkie button. 513-419-7100 if you think you know the answer to the trivia question. So let's go back to what we were starting to talk about there, Ken. How do you describe this? And you're right, it hasn't even been quite a week yet. Whirlwind, anything but boring. I just can't believe the pace things have moved at so far.
Well, you know, it's funny. We always, I guess starting on FDR, we always talked about the first 100 days of the administration. Right. Can you imagine waiting for 100 days to write the narrative of what's going on? I mean, it's less than a week.
And already he's done. Exactly.
First 100 hours,
right.
Maybe.
Right.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. There's two different Donald Trumps. There's a Donald Trump who is strong, who is basically keeping his promises on the wall, on the Affordable Care Act, on immigration, on the pipeline, on Obamacare, all that stuff, climate change, yeah. a conservative Supreme Court. That is fine, but then it gets to the delusional Donald Trump when it comes to the millions of people who voted illegally, or the or obsessing over the crowds, or the fact that the press is making up his differences with the intelligence community, when of course he likened the intelligence agencies to Nazi Germany. So there's a strong Donald Trump who's taking charge from day one as promised, and there's a less than reality based Donald Trump, which is the same concerns we had as a candidate, but now he's president.
And the second one you described is taking away from the first one you described. I mean, it's you know, diverted people's attention, because that's all people talk about is the other side of him.
Yeah, there's almost been as much news coverage about the argument over the inauguration
and part
numbers
of that's the
media's and things
fault
like that.
Too.
Yeah, there's been almost as much about that as you've heard about any of the executive orders that he signed in.
Yeah, but he started it.
Yeah, and what's also interesting is, you know, of course, he spent a lot of time, and the Republicans spent a lot of time complaining about the executive orders that Barack Obama got pushed through when he was president. Although, in fairness, Barack Obama complained about the George W. Bush executive orders. I mean, that's what presidents do. As a candidate, you complain, and then you do it. But the thing that's interesting is, look, Obama did, I'm not excusing or defending anybody, but Obama pushed through his executive orders because he had a Republican Congress that refused to work with him. Donald Trump has a Republican House
exactly.
And Senate, and yet in the first 5-6 days, he's still going past Congress. Well, he's always going past Congress with his tweeting, but also with his executive orders. Basically, I don't want to wait for Congress to go through all the things they have to go through. Let me just take care of this immediately. He is an action-first kind of business guy. He's proving that as a president.
Yeah. Is there a point at which people like Mitch McConnell and Speaker of the House
Paul Ryan?
Yeah, Paul Ryan, just say, wait a minute, slow down. You know, you got to talk to us. You know, we're the ones who control the purse strings.
Well, maybe eventually. I mean, of course, again, I mean, here we are. We're talking about 6 days, which is, I mean, it's just beyond. So, of course, right now, they're still, the Republicans are still giddy that they can, they control everything. I mean, they don't have, there's no, I mean, they control the whole show. But at some point, you know, even Republicans will say, well, you know, there is a legislature. It's a separate branch of government. And if the president is going to be such a strong chief executive that Congress doesn't matter, they may speak up. But again, look, this is 6 days into the whole thing.
Oh, and they've already done that in a way. I mean, you had Trump coming out and saying torture, it works. It's a good interrogation technique. And then all the GOP members of Congress are saying, no, it's against the law. We're not going there.
Right, and the same thing when he said that 3 to 5 million people voted illegally, and Paul Ryan and others and Lindsey Graham said, wait a second, this is just based on nothing.
Yeah, but most of them have not said a thing, and Mitch McConnell is one of them.
Ken, you want to give that trivia question again, and we'll give out the phone number for it again?
Well, right now, you know, we're going through the process of confirming members of President Trump's cabinet. And, of course, several of them are members of Congress, like Jeff Sessions, the senator from Alabama. So my question was, who's the last member of Congress from Ohio who resigned to join an administration?
Okay. And if you think you know the answer to that, 513-419-7100.
Howard.
Howard's
it's not
chief.
Frank Lauschy, it's not Marianne Zelesnik.
I know. So I understand. I've got it written down that. Here.
Yeah. Okay.
Howard's
in blue
again.
Ink.
how many, at this point, Ken, have we lost count, or how many executive orders has President Trump signed?
There's been a bunch. I mean, there's
at least
a
dozen, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's pretty close. I mean,
up to yesterday, I think it was up to 10 or something, but yeah, it's probably a dozen by now.
I mean, starting the process to end Obamacare, right? He killed the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade deal. He removed the references to climate change on the White House website. He renewed the construction of the Keystone XL pipeline and the Dakota Access Pipeline, the one that many Native Americans were protesting. And I mean, it's just, again, he said from the beginning that he would start change immediately. And, you know, you think of all these so-called conservatives who came into office. You think of, you know, Nixon in 68 and Reagan in 80. But even they were not able to do the kind of stuff that conservatives wanted them to do. Donald Trump, who many conservatives didn't even think was a true conservative during the campaign, you know, once he was pro-choice, he gave money to Nancy Pelosi, all that stuff. Suddenly he's become, and his cabinet proves it too, perhaps the most conservative administration, well, and certainly in more than 60, 70 years, maybe ever.
And you talk about the speed of these things and how fast they're coming out. I have a good friend who is a White House correspondent for a major news organization. I won't tell you who it is, but he says that, you know, they're not being briefed on these things. So he has actually had to, and he's glad that Donald Trump, when he signs these things, he holds them up and people take pictures. And this correspondent will blow up the pictures so he can read what
he signed.
What the president just signed.
Oh,
because he's not getting the information from the White House press office.
And that reminds me of the press conference that Donald Trump held, I think, the week before he was sworn in, and he had that press conference with all those manila folders on the table, which apparently were empty. But he pointed to all of them, saying, "Well, here's all my financial dealings," and we never saw what was inside of them.
Right.
You mentioned one of the executive orders about pulling out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and that one's been rather interesting to me because it's created an interesting reaction, an interesting alliance where you have all these labor leaders coming out and saying, this is great, this is perfect, this is exactly what we wanted to see from him.
Bernie Sanders,
that's right, even Bernie Sanders came along and said, I agree with this totally.
Well, I mean, this is the thing that a whole lot of union voters were looking for and listened to Donald Trump and ended up voting for him because of these issues.
See, I never thought that Hillary Clinton's opposition to the TPP was real because, of course, as First Lady and of, you know, being a partner with Bill Clinton, she pushed these trade deals for years. But, of course, given the situation with the Democratic Party and the influence of Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and progressives like that, she said, well, I'm against it, too. But I never felt it was real. There was no question that Donald Trump railed against these, as, you know, NAFTA and the TPP, the worst trade deals for the country. He was going to rip them up. Now, it very well may make China even stronger in the region, in the Asian, you know, the Far East, than it ordinarily would have. But this is what Trump promised to do. And he is, if there's one thing you can say about Donald Trump, he's true to his campaign promises, at least in issues like this.
Well, and what's his approach going to be, Ken? I mean, as opposed to having these broader, more massive agreements, what's he going to do? Negotiate individual agreements with each country or in a region?
Look, so far he's been negotiating individual agreements with each company in the United States, making sure that they bring their jobs home. They could continue to promise to bring manufacturing jobs here and building plants here. Now, of course, Donald Trump's clothing line is still made in China or Hong Kong or wherever it's made. That hasn't changed, but he has said that I'm going to bring jobs home. And many of us, I mean, many analysts said that there's no way many of these jobs are gone forever. But he's, again, fulfilling a campaign promise to make sure it's America. It's an America first policy.
And we have some folks lined up to try the trivia question. So, Ken, give us the question again, and we'll see if anybody out there has the right answer.
The question is, who was the last member of Congress from Ohio who left to join in a presidential administration?
Okay. And let's see. Let's start with Mona in Dry Ridge, Kentucky. Hi, Mona. Who do you think it was?
John Boehner.
John Boehner actually never left. I mean, he left Congress to resign, and he never joined the administration. He basically was forced out by the more conservative members, and he quit Congress, but he never joined the administration.
Okay, thanks for trying there, Mona. Let's see if Corey in Loveland knows the answer. Hi, Corey.
Hey, I think it was John Kasich.
John Kasich, no, John Kasich, he was in Congress, left Congress, and then years later ran for governor, but he didn't resign from Congress to join the administration.
Okay, let's see if Susan in Anderson Township knows. Susan, what do you think the answer is? Howard Metzenbaum.
Nope, Howard Metzenbaum was elected to the Senate in 76, and he retired, I guess, in 98, I believe it was, and he just retired, and he never joined the administration.
Right. And Ken, I know I can't win, but can I throw my answer out there, what I think it might be?
You sure can.
Richard Cordray.
Well, the problem with that is that Richard
Howard's
Cordray
laughing
was never,
at me already.
Well, we're laughing with you. No, we're laughing with you, Mark. No, see, the problem is Richard Cordray was never a member of Congress.
Right.
He was the Attorney General of Ohio, defeated in 2010 by Mike DeWine, but he was never a member of Congress. So,
and so five-time Jeopardy champion.
So, I'm sorry, Howard, you have to make sure that's in the form of a question.
Oh, yep. I'm sorry.
And let's see here. We got one more person here to try. So let's see, Ed in Finneytown. Ed? What do you think the answer is?
My answer is Rob Portman.
Rob Portman is the correct answer.
Very good.
Very good. All right. Way to go.
Rob Portman was a member of Congress from, I guess, the Cincinnati area, who resigned in 2005 to become President Bush's trade representative. And, of course, now he's in the Senate. But, yes, Rob Portman is the correct answer. An earlier one would have been William Saxby, who left the Senate in 1973 to be Nixon's Attorney General. But Rob Portman is the correct answer.
Absolutely.
And what did you write, Howard?
What does it say there? My man.
You wrote that after you heard Ed say it.
No,
Rob,
did not.
He did write right. Rob Portman. Ed,
and this says Bill Saxby underneath him.
Wow. I was convinced I thought the smartest answer I've ever heard in my life was Richard Cordray, because Mark is the host of the show.
Right. Yeah.
But let's say congratulations, Ed. Good job.
Very good.
Stay on the line so we can get the address to send your prize to. So congratulations on winning that. And we will continue our conversation with Ken Rudin and Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, host of The Splendid Table. You don't have to have lots of money, live in luxury, or eat at the finest restaurants to appreciate cultural offerings. You just need to tune into public radio, because that's one of the core principles of public radio. Quality news and culture available to everyone. You hear important conversations, beautiful music, and so much more here every day. We're asking you to do your part with a gift of support. Whether it's a little or a lot, it makes a difference to this station. Here's someone to tell you how. And thank you.
We are very grateful you choose to listen to public radio, and we're also grateful for the support the stations receive from you and your fellow listeners every year. It's your support that keeps these stations going strong. Your contribution sustains and protects WVXU here in Cincinnati and Northern Kentucky, or WMUB in Richmond and Oxford. So make that tax-deductible gift right now while you're thinking about it. 513-419-7155 is the phone number to call. You can also contribute online at wvxu.org or wmub.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. And joining us for a look at the first week of the Trump presidency and what could happen during his first 100 days in office are political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100. Again, that's 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Howard, it goes without saying that this has been just, whether you like what's happening or not, you can't deny this has been an amazing first 6 days.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's unprecedented. You know, as far as I can remember. And Ken is exactly right. I mean, it's going on two fronts. You know, you've got this strong President Trump who is, you know, delivering on campaign promises. And then you've got this other guy who is just, you know, kind of talking about, like, things that seem crazy.
Arguing over inauguration numbers.
Yeah, inauguration
berating
numbers.
The press.
Well, and then the thing about, you know, the fraudulent voters, which is just totally absurd. The millions of fraudulent voters cast ballots. Now, fraudulent voting does occur, but it's more like in the dozens than the millions. And if he wants to do a study of that, he's going to find that out.
Let me expand on that a little bit, because what it really seems to be is that he's the president, he's the king, he's mm-hmm. as James Cagney would say, I'm on top of the world. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, he lost the popular vote by 2.8 million votes, if not more, to Hillary Clinton, and that galls him.
Oh, I
that
think just, it makes him says, crazy. Yeah,
exactly. So he's saying that the only way that must have happened was that 3 to 5 million people voted illegally. Now, what's interesting about that is, first of all, as Howard says completely correctly, there's no evidence to bear that at all. He cites a Pew study that right. he actually miscites it, which is completely wrong. And so we could talk about whether it's a falsehood or an alternative fact or lying, but it's clearly not true. Yeah. But at the same time, when people try to do recounts and look into the vote into Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, the Republicans stopped those recounts, those Jill Stein-inspired recounts, right after the election. They said there's no reason to, because there's no fraud involved. It's all, you know, all fine. But what makes me nervous about this is that if Donald Trump insists that there are so much illegal votes, he could add on to the voting restrictions that we're seeing pop up around right. the country about voter ID and you have to be a certain this or that. So I wonder if this is just a ruse. Well, one, I think it's about ego that he didn't get the popular vote. But two, if he follows up on it, I wonder if it'll be an excuse to institute more clampdowns on the free ability to vote.
That's exactly what the Democrats fear the most. That's what this is all about. Now, I don't think there's any question it's in large part about ego and the fact that he did not win the popular vote in any way, shape, or form. but it does, it could possibly give the Republicans in Congress and the Trump administration an opening to what Democrats look at as voter suppression.
Right. Right. And the state legislatures, too.
State legislatures, North Carolina, Texas. Yeah. I mean, Ohio's legislature has been sued numerous times.
And I don't know if he's done this yet or not, Ken, but the AP was reporting that he was going to sign an executive action today to launch an investigation into those claims of voter fraud. So that was earlier today. So.
And he wasn't planning to do that. He basically said, well, I'm just making the case. And then when reporters
started pressing him, they said, now we're going to have an investigation. And I was talking to the Ohio Democratic Party chairman yesterday, and he said, okay, fine, let's have an investigation. Maybe you can find out why all of those voting machines in Detroit went belly up on Election Day.
Well, there's a history of that, and you know that as well as anybody, Howard, that in poorer neighborhoods around the country, it just so happens the lines are longer, there are fewer voting machines, and somehow these machines break down, right?
Exactly.
Well, and then he's claiming millions of illegal votes.
Three to five million, that's just not true.
It is not true. I talked to the Republican Secretary of State in Ohio yesterday about this, and you know he says, okay, yeah, we find over the last 2012 and 2014 elections we had about 600 and some irregularities. There were about 220 cases that were referred to law enforcement, and of those only a handful were ever prosecuted. I mean,
and you know that's
out of 8.7 million votes cast.
Yeah. And he also railed against those who are registered to vote in more than one place, right, which includes his daughter.
And Bannon, too.
Right, Steve Bannon, right. But look, a lot of people are registered to vote in two separate places. Maybe they moved and they didn't unregister. If you vote in two separate places, that's illegal. But if you're registered, that happens more than not.
Oh, yeah.
And it includes Steve Bannon and his daughter, so that's interesting.
Yeah.
Let's talk to David in Claremont County. Get him in on the conversation here. Hi, David.
Good morning. No, it's afternoon. You have been talking about exactly the topic that I'm concerned about. He makes these outrageous exaggeration statements, which some of the Republicans go behind him and try to clean it up. And then everybody is talking about how outrageous it is. Meanwhile, in the background, there are these major changes that I think people should be focusing on, and instead they're getting totally consumed with what looks like a mentally unstable president.
Well,
and I'm wondering what you think foreign leaders think when they see this, and he says one thing and then turns around and says, well, I didn't really mean that. How can they believe anything that he says, and how can he negotiate in any kind of stable fashion with other world leaders?
Well, I mean, that's a question. I don't know how you answer that question. We do know that Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel had an awful relationship with Obama, and he's obviously looking forward to his relationship with Trump. Trump is even talking about moving the U.S. Embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which every president talks about, but nobody would ever dare do. Trump could very well do it. There's a lot of things, and of course, he took a phone call from the president of Taiwan, which, of course, drives. You know why I think he talked to the president of Taiwan is because he has a Taipei personality. Anyway, okay,
oh,
so that's
no.
so, yeah, sorry. But I mean, but also he will do things like that will, of course, have a complete eruption with China. He doesn't seem to know, or maybe he does know, but there are major consequences to these seemingly innocent tweets and statements he makes that could just, you know, unravel the whole world.
And some of these things, he says the more outrageous things. They are diversions. They're diversions from much more serious issues that are out there, coming from these executive orders on things like immigration, for example.
Ken, do you know?
I just to say, expanding quickly on what David just said, and we've seen a whole evidence of this. Like sometimes he'll attack like Meryl Streep or something in a tweet, and then everybody will be focused on this tweet while everything else is happening and nobody's paying attention.
Everybody's talking about Meryl Streep or Madonna or something else. Yeah.
We had a comment from John. He said, with Trump, you need to be aware of, look at this hand, while something else is going on in the other hand. So, yeah.
Well, I think there's some truth to that, yes.
Yeah. 513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And you can also email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk to George in Milford. Hi, George. Go right ahead, George.
Hi. The other day I heard on the news, a public radio program, talking to somebody who represents the steel industry in the country, that when Trump guaranteed that the pipelines would be restarted and put an emphasis on, and you will use U.S. steel, I wonder, how is that possible that U.S. industries can, if this goes on, really acquiesce to that? Because most of the time it's like a bidding process, and if U.S. steel isn't being used, it's because there's cheaper steel available, and that's that is a consideration I know that Trump has, and a lot of other people too. But it's going to change things dramatically, and maybe companies will start losing business because they can't provide the materials at the lower cost that they had been getting.
That's exactly right. That's exactly why companies do go overseas and manufacture overseas, right? Because labor is much cheaper. Donald Trump has said from the beginning that that it's hurting American workers. And of course, you're right. It's because it's much cheaper to do it overseas. But by talking about imposing tariffs on companies if they don't manufacture in the U.S., he's going to impose a tariff of 35% on their products. Everything will be more expensive, and so there will be hidden outcomes that Donald Trump seems to not being paying attention to, but again, it goes hand in hand with his rhetoric of being an America first president, and that's part of the argument.
Yeah, I mean, China dumping cheap steel in the U.S. It's been responsible for losing a whole lot of the steel industry jobs, and those jobs really aren't coming back.
Well, and then the Wall Street Journal brought up an interesting point in talking about him putting stipulations on these pipelines, if those stipulations might not actually succeed in killing off these projects.
Well, you still there?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry. But then the claim made by the proponents of these pipelines is that they will create 50,000 new jobs. But these are very, very temporary jobs most studies show that maybe we're talking about 50 to 75 jobs total. And we're not talking about the environmental damage, the environmental havoc that it could cause. And of course, the upheaval with the Native American communities in the Dakotas, as we've seen. But look, we also have the nominee for the Environmental Protection Agency head, who is a complete climate change denier. So all the entire environmental mindset, forget about the economic, but the environmental mindset that we've seen in the last 8 years has dramatically changed as of January 20th. But again, not a surprise.
Again, 513-419-7100 if you'd like to join our conversation. And you were mentioning the EPA nominee, that's Scott Pruitt, correct?
Yes.
How many of his nominees for various positions, how many have been confirmed so far?
Well, two of the cabinet. You have James Mattis, who's the Secretary of Defense, who seems to be widely admired by members of both parties.
He seems to be the voice of reason, maybe.
He does. He said absolutely during his confirmation hearings that absolutely no way will I acquiesce in bringing back torture, even though Donald Trump talked about it yesterday in his conversation with David Muir and ABC News. But Mattis says absolutely no way. He was confirmed on a 98-1 vote. John Kelly, General John Kelly, was confirmed as Homeland Security Secretary. And that's the only two members of the cabinet so far. Mike Pompeo, the congressman from Kansas, has been confirmed as CIA Director. And Nikki Haley, the governor of South Carolina, was confirmed as UN Ambassador. but others like Rex Tillerson. Look, Rex Tillerson is going to go through. Marco Rubio, who was threatening to vote no, ultimately voted yes. John McCain and Lindsey Graham say they'll vote yes. So there really is no opposition to Tillerson. There are others, though, like Tom Price for HHS and Betsy DeVos for education. There are questions about that. Andy Puzner for Labor Secretary. There are questions about these guys and gals, but whether you'll get the three Republicans to vote against them, which would, as assuming there's a Democratic, united Democratic opposition. So that's the only way you'll defeat them, is either you get three Republicans to vote no, or they wind up withdrawing their nomination, as we saw with Tom Daschle, for example, or Bill Richardson, because of some ethics problems. But right now, even with ethics problems, everybody seems to be full speed ahead.
So who do you think is going to have the toughest road ahead of them? Is it Betsy DeVos?
First of all, her. I think her resume and her portfolio is filled with ethics questions and conflicts. She didn't handle herself well during her confirmation hearings when she seemed to not understand certain terms about education. And, of course, clearly she's a proponent of private education, private schools and charter schools, not public schools. And, of course, that gets the Democrats riled up and the unions riled up, but you need to rile up three Republicans, and we'll see. Look, I'm out of the prediction. Donald Trump has said to me that I'm out of the prediction business forever. but at the same time, Betsy DeVos, Andy Puzner, maybe Tom Price, but probably DeVos and Puzner have the toughest walls to scale. Whether they get defeated is another thing altogether.
What do you think about Jim Sessions, Attorney General? What do you think of that?
Jeff Sessions, absolutely. Jeff Sessions is, first of all, there are 51 Republicans in the Senate minus Sessions. Even Susan Collins of Maine says he's a great guy. So there's going to be obviously opposition from civil rights organizations, but no Republican has said they'll vote against him. That's part of the club. It's hard to vote against one of your own, right. Although Republicans did vote against John Tower in 1989, but Tower had so many issues about him. This was John Tower, the senator from Texas,
who was George H.W.
Special case with alcoholism and womanizing and conflicts and stuff like that, because it was very funny to see the Senate turn down John Tower, who was accused of womanizing and alcoholism, when half the members of the Senate back then were womanizers and alcoholics. But, that's another thing altogether.
We will continue our conversation with Ken and Howard. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
I'm Marnie Ball, and I listen to public radio. My favorite time probably is in the morning to get up to date with what's happened in the world while I happen to be asleep. All things considered, in the afternoon, it gives you that transition period from work back into what's happening in the world. They always have those really nice life feature interviews and the music and the books, those sort of things that help decompress from the day. Public radio is a part of my life. I support public radio, and I hope you do too.
It only takes about 3 minutes to do your part to help pay for all the great shows that you hear on 91.7 WVXU. And when you call, a volunteer is going to ask for your contact information, how much you'd like to give, and how you'd like to pay. It's as easy as that. A contribution of $120, that works out to just about 33 cents a day. So please take a moment right now to make that contribution, 513-419-7155, or you can give online at wvxu.org or wmub.org. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney, and joining us for a look at the first week of the Trump presidency and what could happen during his first 100 days in office are political junkie Ken Rudin and WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Jim and Mason joins us now. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you.
I hate to take you back to a previous part of the conversation, but just two quick comments. One about the popular vote. If California went to Hillary by about 3 million votes, so take California out, and he, by and large, won the popular vote of the other 49. And then my other comment was about Biden, the U.S. made steel for those projects. we have minority set-asides in every major city in this country on bidding. It doesn't necessarily go to the lowest bidder. And so what would be the difference here in saying that, you know, that we have, you have to buy American? I don't see a problem with that. So, but anyway, those are just a couple of comments.
Just your thought. Okay. Thank you, Jim.
Well, okay, I'll jump in here. Well, first of all, Jim says if we took California out of the equation, Donald Trump would have won the popular vote. How about this? If we took Wisconsin and Michigan out of the equation, right, Hillary Clinton would have won the Electoral College vote.
Well, there were about 80,000 people in those few states that made him president.
Yeah, yeah, and the popular vote debate, no matter which side you're on, it's just not relevant because the Electoral College system, right, is what elects the president. So, you know, you have to win the popular votes in as many of the 50 states as you possibly can to get elected. That's the way the system works, and it's
right. But I'm saying if you can't take California out, just like you couldn't take Wisconsin. Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Right. And as far as the U.S. Steel, look, at on paper it makes sense. Why not buy American? Why not hire American? I mean, that's the way it used to be when we want to make America great again. Back in the days, that's what we did. So there's no argument against it, except financial. There are companies who say that, look, it'll cost us 10 times, if not more, right, as much to buy just American, to purchase American, than it would be to purchase overseas. It's a sad commentary about the way the economics of the country is situated right now, but it's what reality is all about.
Yeah, it's the companies. I mean, the companies obviously want the cheapest deal they can get and, you know, to be able to do the job. And that is not buying American steel at this point.
Aaron in Liberty Township joins us now. Hi, Aaron.
Hey, how's it going?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, I just got a comment about the steel topic again. The last couple of years, I've been a commercial flatbed truck driver all over the Midwest, primarily hauling steel. Now, I kept hearing throughout the election, everything's failing and steel's not doing well. I can personally attest it couldn't be further from the truth. Carrollton, Kentucky has a company called North American Stainless that did over a $300 million expansion last year alone. There was another company in Saltville, Wisconsin called Charter Steel. They were also doing a multi-hundred million dollar expansion as well. So I hear all these people saying how all the steel companies are going badly when there's such a shortage of truck drivers, they don't have enough people to move this stuff. And I was in Pennsylvania, Chicago, Iowa. I mean, you name all over the Midwest, and all these steel companies, I mean, they're putting out 24 hours a day. So I don't know what they were talking about, the steel companies not making money or all these, and they are hiring everywhere. I mean, they couldn't get enough people to build the stuff, let alone transport it. So that was just my two cents, you know, being an inside trucker on the whole thing.
Aaron, thank you.
I think I like Aaron's point. I kind of think it's not a question of whether there's a surplus or availability of steel. I just think it's the price of it. So right, Aaron is offering a perspective that has not been heard much in the media, and I like to hear that. But I still think it comes to dollars and cents and maybe what companies could do better by purchasing overseas.
513-419-7100 to join us. And let's talk to Jim in Milford. Hi, Jim.
Hello. Good to talk to you. For the longest time, I've been waiting for someone to comment about a best-selling book from the early 60s, the plot of which was the president was soft on Russia, and with Trump's relationship with Russia, that seems to fit, and that because of this, the military decided to have a coup. And, of course, we have four generals in the administration. And the book was 7 days in May. Mm-hmm. Has Howard or Ken heard any references to this? Because I haven't yet, and I'm kind of surprised I haven't.
I don't know. I hadn't thought about it, but, you know, I read that book and I saw the movie, too.
I have thought about it because, one, when Donald Trump was campaigning, he says he knows much more than the generals know.
Right.
And yet, you know, as Jim points out, he has appointed generals to the cabinet. James Mattis, Secretary of Defense, John Kelly for Homeland Security. So he's appointed these generals that he doesn't have much in common with. But you're absolutely right. The fact is that what's driving John McCain nuts about the situation is not so much that Rex Tillerson has business deals with Putin or Moscow or things like that. But what Donald Trump's relationship is with the former Soviet Union. So
yeah.
While I don't think anybody, including Jim, is proposing a military coup right now, but again, if there are a lot of members of Congress, and I assume in the military as well, who may be very nervous about what Donald Trump has done and has dealt with and is pals with in Moscow and the Kremlin. Of course, we don't know the financial dealings because he won't reveal his tax returns. But even just talking, the fact is the Donald Trump will criticize intelligence agencies. He'll criticize the CIA. He'll criticize Obama. But he hasn't criticized Putin or Russia. That is alarming to a lot of people.
And I think General Mattis is a person who would speak very frankly to this president about this country's strategic position in the world and what needs to be done.
Can I talk about another book from the 60s? Because there was a reference to it in the New York Times. When I was a kid, I read this book. It was called None Dare Call It Treason.
Yes.
I don't know, Howard, I don't know if you remember that at all. But
sure.
John Stormer
Absolutely.
Wrote the book, and I guess in the early 60s.
Yeah.
And basically it was saying that everybody in the government is really a pawn of the Soviet Union. And they're all communists, and we're being duped by the communists.
Yeah.
And as a kid, when I read it, I mean, I wasn't a fact checker in the early days, but I read it and I said, oh my goodness, if this is true, this is pretty incredible.
Yeah.
So you do have the fiction of 7 days in May. You do have the alternative facts of None Dare Call It Treason. But there's a lot of books out there that makes you question the loyalties and the policies of your government, and the fantasy of a None Dare Call It Treason could be a reality if there are a lot of people who object to what Donald Trump has to say about Russia.
Let's talk to Sharon in Pleasant Ridge. Hi, Sharon.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good, thank you.
So I was at the Women's March in Washington, D.C.
Thank you for somebody mentioning this subject, because I was afraid we wouldn't talk about it. Thank you.
Well, I wasn't going to let you, so I wanted to call in and hear your thoughts.
Good.
She's going to keep us straight. Thank you.
Good.
So first is, I was astonished by the crowd, the energy. If people think millennials are not engaged, that's a mistake. They were there in the majority. And so I'm wondering about your thoughts about what is that and what does that mean? And also, we have a president who's now, like, churning out executive orders. What's the long-term scenario on that? When does our Congress start to feel cut out? What do they start to say? If things go wrong, what happened? You know, where do you see this leading in 2 to 3 years?
Okay, that's a lot of territory to cover, but you're absolutely right.
You pick which one you like.
Okay. The Women's March, and it was amazing here, too. So many people showed up just about a block away from our studios and marched down to City Hall by the thousands. And I think they were basically they were putting this administration on notice. We're not going to sit by and do nothing if you're going to start messing with people's individual rights, whether it's women, whether it's gays and lesbians, whether it's African-Americans, Muslims, and they were all represented in this march, both in Washington and in the cities all over the country, and really all over the world, too. I think it was just to basically put this administration on notice.
You think this was the start of the progressive version of the Tea Party that we're seeing with this?
Sure, absolutely it is. There's no question in my mind, and it's going to stay together. I talked to these people, the people that organized this, and they're going to do this periodically. They're going to do it whenever they feel like the Trump administration has crossed the line when it comes to individual rights and human rights, and it's not going away.
Sharon, thank you so much for bringing this up, because I really wanted to talk about this. I live outside of Washington. The crowds here were 500,000 people.
Yeah.
The lines to get to the metro to get into Washington, where people were in line for 2 hours just to get on the train on the regular
subway.
I saw your
photo on that. That was
it's
amazing.
Unbelievable the mobs. But I checked with the White House. I checked with the Trump administration. They said only 48 people showed up to the march. No, I'm kidding about that part. But you know, there's obsessed with numbers. But here's the real answer to Sharon's question, which actually I don't have. What is next? I mean, it's great. It was you know, a response the next day to the Trump administration, not only what the Trump administration may do, but to everything that Trump said as a candidate about women, about their bodies, about their looks, about reproductive freedoms and all those things. But what can they do other than march? They don't have votes in Congress. I think what you heard in those rallies basically was you need to run for office. You don't have to,
right,
you know,
exactly.
You don't have to wait for every 4 years to run for president.
Absolutely.
Run for city council, run for Congress, run for state legislature.
And Ken, that's
work for
exactly
the
what they're doing. I mean, that is exactly what they're doing in this city. That's happening in this election, in this municipal election.
And go back to what I was asking Howard a few minutes ago about the idea that, and I've heard this from a number of places, that this was the seeds of a progressive version of the Tea Party. You think that's what we're seeing? We've got something with some staying power here?
Well, the anger is the same. When we saw the Tea Party in 2009, 2010, as a response to Obama and Obamacare, that was real and visceral, and whatever it is, there was anger there. There is definitely anger here. But how long it lasts and how strong they can be. I mean, if they're impotent in Congress, they may be impotent around the world. It's a very good question. I mean, there's no answer to it, but the point is the anger is there. And of course, Donald Trump said, well, if they're so angry, they should have voted. Well, they did vote, and 54% of the women voted for Hillary Clinton, but white women voted for Donald Trump. And that's pretty astounding as well. And so if 500,000 people, maybe a million plus around the country, participate in these marches, well, you know, they all came from New Jersey and Maryland and California and Oregon and Washington and Colorado. Well, those states voted for Hillary Clinton. So I don't know what changes.
And Ken, I wanted to ask you this before we wrapped up the show. We're talking about executive orders earlier, and one of those that he signed is to actually build the wall on the border between the U.S. and Mexico. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that and your take on that whole thing.
Well, you know, of course, for all the campaign, he said, we're going to build the wall and Mexico will pay for it. President Peña Nieto said, I don't think so. I don't think he said it in English, but he said, I don't think so. And now Congress and Paul Ryan are saying, well, you know what, we'll pay for the wall, which looks like it'll be $20 billion. He's talking about cutting $100 million out of the national, you know, public radio and things like that. He'll cut out, you know, $53 for those things, but he'll bet $20 billion on a wall that his own defense secretary said is not going to keep people, and it's not going to do the job that he wants it to do. And an answer to Sharon's earlier question, when will Congress respond? Well, that's a great question, because everything Donald Trump is doing is bypassing Congress. He's pushing through his executive orders. And at some point, the McCains and the Paul Ryans are going to stand up and say, wait a second, don't forget about us. We have a role to play as well.
They're going to get tired of being pushed around. Yes.
You were saying $20 billion now. Paul Ryan was saying this morning $12 to $15 billion is what he thinks it's going to cost. But, you know, with these things, you get these estimates, and then they usually do turn out being a lot more than what they say.
The point is, nobody knows where it's going to come from anyway.
Yeah. Well, and that's
we do know there were 12 billion people at Trump's inauguration.
Oh, well, yeah.
You know, yeah. I saw the pictures. Yeah.
If they each donated a dollar.
You're right.
So it was interesting. Trump was telling ABC, he said, I'm telling you there will be a payment. And he's talking about Mexico, and he says it will be in a form, perhaps a complicated form, and that was where the whole thought ended. And I'm sitting there thinking, where is he going with that? Is he thinking of renegotiating NAFTA to get something back, or I just can't figure it out.
Well, clearly that the U.S. has a deficit with Mexico with these trade deals, so I don't know what leverage we possibly have. I think that's why already the Congress is saying, that's why I think the president of Mexico said, I'm not coming, and then when he said, I'm not coming, Trump said, oh, I may not invite him. I mean, it's silly, and it seems like the bill will be on not only the Republican lawmakers' chairs and votes, but out of our pockets as well. And right. But, you know, this... it's alternative reality, guys.
Yep. Yeah. Going back to the Women's March, Rebecca on Facebook had a question, and I don't know if you know this or not, Howard. She wondered if we had an official count for the Cincinnati march.
You know, we never did get an official count.
Thousands and thousands,
Cincinnati,
from what I understand, but never anything definite.
I mean, there was at least I would say there were at least 6,000 people there. There could have been as many as 10,000. The estimates vary, but we've never gotten an official count. Believe me, there were a lot of people there.
Well, that's what she's saying, too. Rebecca says it was probably the biggest march she's seen in 15 years.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. Ken and Howard, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you so much. Only 6 days into the administration.
Political junkie Ken Rudin, WVXU political reporter Howard Wilkinson. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition. Archives of our programs are available at WVXU.org. Pete Reitmeier was the producer for today's show. Belinda Kai was the assistant producer. Dave Shermer was the technical director. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. I'm Mark Haney. Stay tuned for Here and Now, coming up next on 91.7 WVXU. Each Friday on Cincinnati Edition, local editors and reporters join us for a look at the events, people, and organizations affecting our region and to analyze the stories behind the headlines. And we invite you to ask questions and share your opinions about the latest news in the tri-state and how it was covered by the local media. That's our weekly news review on the next Cincinnati Edition, Friday afternoon at 1 on 91.7 WVXU.